Hello, this is Carrie Weber from America Magazine. I'm here today with Father James Martin.
Great to be here.
And Jesuit Scholastic Kevin Spinelli.
Good afternoon.
And we're here for another of our summer editors roundtable discussions. We've got a host of topics today, including drought and famine in Somalia, a digital library, and unemployment. So, Jim, maybe if you could start us off with talking a little bit about what's going on in Somalia.
Well, I thought about a couple topics we could talk about this afternoon, but this was the most pressing, I think, and sort of near and dear to my heart since I worked in Kenya for 2 years. Basically, it's the worst drought in 60 years in the Horn of Africa, which is the place towards the east. It looks like a horn, Somalia, Kenya. And there are, I think, tens of thousands of Somali refugees who are moving from Somalia, which is in the north, to Kenya, to northern Kenya, to a place called Dadaab, where a lot of the refugees are congregating. And I think it's just important for people to know that it's happening. And also, you know, as Catholics, we tend to feel a certain sense of despair. It's been called compassion fatigue, that there's nothing we can do. But there are many places that we can contribute, most especially Catholic relief services, which are terrific in terms of getting people on the ground and getting the food to the famine victims, as well as Jesuit Refugee Service. So I just wanted to alert people to the opportunity to help in a very desperate situation.
Now, when you were in Kenya, did you experience any of these refugee camps directly?
I did. I visited camps in northern Uganda, where southern Sudanese were streaming in, and also camps around Nairobi. I worked primarily with refugees in Nairobi who had settled there as urban refugees. But I did work with a lot of Somalis. And, you know, for people who remember the 1990s, that country has really been struggling. And, of course, you know, as always, it's the poor that suffer the most. Frequently, famines are the result of sort of government policies, and Somalia is really sort of a leaderless society at this point. There's a saying in Swahili, which is basically, I don't remember my Swahili very well, but it's when the elephants fight, the grass suffers. And the idea is that it's always the poor who suffer these internecine battles. So I would just, you know, like to take this time to invite people to feel that compassion. I think probably when you hear these stories, you feel that there's nothing you can do. You might feel this sense of sorrow. And to recognize that that sorrow and that compassion and that pity is really God sort of calling you and inviting you to respond in some way.
Now, there's a militant group in Somalia that has actually banned some of the aid agencies,
right?
And that's being reversed now, hopefully. Do you think they'll be able to rebound from that?
They're trying to. Apparently, the places that it's the worst are places where, you know, not surprisingly, it's run by Al-Qaeda. You know, they can sort of prevent food shipments from coming in. And, you know, governments use food as kind of a weapon against the poor. And but I think, you know, my experience in East Africa is that really, if there is one group that can do this, it is Catholic Relief Service. I mean, they are very well respected. They have the know-it-all, and they know, they have people on the ground to know the situation, you know, even better than the people in Washington can. So I think for anyone who doubts that their money is going to get there, Catholic Relief Services not only has low overhead, but also has the know-how to get the food to where it needs to go.
Right, that's good. And that's a really good point that you bring up about the compassion fatigue, because mm-hmm. Even, I mean, there's so many issues just within our own country. Mm-hmm. A lot of people say, well, I care about the poor, but, you know, only the ones right next to me. Or, you know, it's hard to decide which cause you want to contribute to or fight to, especially in a downturn in the economy.
It is. And I think from a spiritual point of view, I put some pictures up on our blog just to sort of open people's hearts. I think to recognize that those things that you feel most upset about, you know, or most sad about, may be one way that God is speaking to you. How else could God sort of affect what change needs to happen? Sometimes at Mass, we pray during the prayers of the faithful, you know, oh God, help the poor. Well, I think, you know, a lot of that help comes through God moving people's hearts and opening their hearts in order to get them to act, basically. So I think, you know, to your point, if you feel a sense of pity, to kind of respond.
Right. Yeah, that combination of prayer and action is key, just
yes.
In general.
Yes, I agree.
One of the things I was surprised at in the Catholic News Service information that you sent us, Jim, was that there was an official from the UN who said that this was the largest or the worst humanitarian disaster in the world. And that's hard to believe, especially with what's happening in Japan and other parts of the world. So that should be some basic motivation to contribute or to help or at least to pray And another number that astounded me, 2 million kids are malnourished. Mm-hmm. And the suffering of children just mm-hmm. wrenches the heart. Right. It is unfathomable that that many kids don't have enough to eat. So just basic numbers also should provoke compassion, prayer, and assistance to share in the suffering of these people.
I agree, and I think to hear those numbers, it can be overwhelming, but it can also be a good goad, as you point out, for us to act. The other number I heard was in August, it might be as many as 2,500 people a day dying over there. And it's a very simple thing. I mean, people, sometimes I think poverty is made to seem so complex, right? You know, the situation.
Right.
But you really can just open up your checkbook and write a check. I mean, sometimes it's not that complex. And I think that that, in addition to prayer and advocacy, are some things that Catholics can do.
Right. Especially if we're trying to sometimes, in some places, hold people over until systemic changes can take mm-hmm. place. Because, you know, the combination of charity and systemic change is important, too.
Right. Right. Together.
Let's move on to a topic in this country, which is unemployment. That's been causing a lot of problems for people, a lot of suffering of a different sort. But one problem people have been having recently is they're going to look for a job, and the ads say they're not hiring people who are unemployed, which I have found to be crazy on several levels, because I think, you know, the people who are affected by unemployment are disproportionately older people and minorities. So this puts those groups in a worse place than they already are, being unemployed. And so that's one factor. And then it just, you know, eliminates an entire group of people who may have those skills.
I was pretty shocked when you sent that article around. I had not heard that. And for our listeners, we editors send the articles around we're going to talk about so we can know what to comment on. But I was appalled, actually. And I'm wondering if that's illegal. Is it discriminatory? Can you say we are not going to look at people who are unemployed? Is that a kind of discrimination?
Well, they've just passed a law in New Jersey, which has made it illegal. Some people, I was reading on the Times Room for Debate blog, one guy was arguing that it would make businesses not want to go to New Jersey. So it's, you know, saying this is going to be counterproductive because now there'll be no businesses and no jobs to not hire people mm-hmm. for. And it's also very hard to prove. It's very hard to prove you didn't hire me because I was unemployed. It's not as, I mean, it's hard to prove the other forms of discrimination anyway, but this is even more difficult. You know, I think employers need to look at people's skill levels, and it's also hard because in some industries, 6 months out of the industry may put you further behind, and so it is a hard balance.
And they also have to look at, you know, what's the cause of the employment. I mean, beyond just the bad economy, that sometimes it's not in people's control, you know, whether or not they got downsized, and it shouldn't be something that penalizes them and prevents them from getting a new job.
Right.
Or if you work for Bear Stearns and the company fell out underneath you. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not as if you were redundant or incompetent employee. The company folded, so you have no place to go. You're 45, you have kids. You're out of work for 6 months. What are you going to do? How are you going to put food on the table? There's not going to be a job comparable in salary readily available, so you have to exist somehow. Take whatever you can get.
Yeah, I read another article on, I think it was Slate, about a lot of folks who had been unemployed for a year or 2 years and had found other jobs, but basically most of them were at a fraction of the salary that they were at before. And so people are underemployed.
Now, what's the business response to that? I'm sure they have some sort of response of why they're feeling forced to do this. Is there a sort of reasonable response, these are more motivated people? Is that what they're arguing?
I think there's sort of the idea that on some level people want what people who are wanted. You know, if the company mm-hmm. keeps you and you're wanted, you're obviously good talent. You're sort of higher in the pool if they're doing layoffs. And if they are able to cut you without any loss to the company, I think they say, well, then why would you contribute to our company?
But as Kevin was saying, and speaking as a former person who was mm-hmm. in HR myself for GE, I mean, you know, an intelligent HR person and an intelligent manager should know that a lot of these things are outside of people's control. I mean, you know, if Bear Stearns goes under or you were working for Lehman Brothers, you know, it's not your fault that you're out of work. And so it's very short-sighted. It's another indication, I think, of a sort of prejudice against the poor as well.
It is. And it's true. The average unemployment length is now 9 months. So, you know, people who have skill sets after 6 months are almost unemployable, even if they do have the skill sets you're talking about. and are actually really good at their jobs. Mm-hmm. You still want to hire the best person for the mm-hmm. job. It's not, you can't hire everyone out of pity.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're shooting themselves in the foot too.
Right.
I mean, because they're cutting off a huge portion of the workforce, mm-hmm. you know, that could be, you know, very productive, you know,
right.
in their companies.
Exactly. And really eager to work harder after having been out of work for so long. I don't know. I've also read it said, you know, that it may eventually contribute to a drop in unemployment because people who are older will just stop looking for work.
Right, right.
Which is, you know, not the kind
it's
of drop
sad.
In unemployment we're looking
yeah.
for.
I think there's another reason why it, it's an employer's market.
Mm-hmm.
So you get the most talented folks you can, and the most talented folks are usually still employed or most desirable, at least on paper, have jobs. So they're more attractive. It's sort of like I think of the academic world and, you know, folks, professors that are up and coming in tenure track position are attractive to other schools. Rather than somebody who's basically hanging on at a community college, getting a contract semester to semester, larger schools, I mean, it's an employer's market. There's a flood of viable candidates, so they'll take what's in the mix already, what people that are already attractive, already employed. So.
Right. Yeah, I read an article about academia in that sense a while ago, where sort of there's this curse of the adjunct professor, where you end up being, you know, sort of underemployed as an adjunct for several different schools for years and years and years.
And making very little money.
Right.
And being treated poorly and having no benefits. Yeah, it's terrible.
Right. Well, let's move on to something slightly more uplifting, which is somewhat related to universities as well. The creation of a public digital library. Kevin, do you want to tell us about that?
Sure. There's a gentleman who's the head of the Harvard Library System named Robert Darnton, who has been writing in New York Review of Books for the last several years about the creation of a digital library that holds basically every book that has been published or in print in at least the West. Google says that there are probably 150 million volumes, 150 million books in the world, of which they've already scanned 15 million. And intend to, even though there's been a couple of lawsuits and a settlement which was rejected in early this spring, they still intend to somehow scan as much as they can and maybe get close to that number by 2020. However, this gentleman, Mr. Darnton, is trying to get together a number of private foundations in the United States and research libraries throughout Europe and the U.S., to pool their research resources and try to create an open access library. There are several problems. There's still, for some reason, there's a what they call a black hole. There are books published from 1924 to 1964 that have unclear copyright rules attached to them, and it's a big hole. It would be a big hole in the catalog were they just not a part of the final product. So there has to be some legislation on the federal level regarding, you know, if those books are brought into the catalog, who would be compensated. So he's trying to raise resources, the money, the technical know-how, because once all of these libraries pool their resources together, there needs to be some way of sorting out keywords, themes. They call this metadata, how to organize that. This morning, Darnton always points to this database in Europe called Europeana, which is financed by the EU. And I was just playing around with this morning, and I found a copy, a 1553 copy of The Spiritual Exercise of Ignatius from the University of Coimbra. And the scanning was quite nice. I mean, it was quite legible. So, I mean, databases can help scholars. And I think that this is one of Darnton's points, is it's beneficial for the public good, for academia. Not only that, it's a public alternative to a commercial enterprise run by Google, which could use private information such as who looks at what passages are looked at when these passages are, and could also restrict access to books, you know, millions of books, or ask for chunks of catalogs to be scanned from public libraries and then go back to these libraries and charge them fees to use Google service.
Sell it back to them.
Right.
Can I ask you something? I've followed this with interest in the New York Review of Books, and it's interesting to me how he's went from scholar to advocate. One of the things I think the audience might be interested in is how is it that Google has been able to, in a sense, unilaterally go after these books and scan them? Are they not? I mean, I would think that most people would understand books that were in the public domain, but how are they able legally to do that?
Back in like 2005, 2006, Darnton took over the Harvard Library in 2007. Several libraries, New York Public Library, Harvard, Oxford, all said yes to Google and allowed them to take in their collections. So there's been, at the initial stages of this, before the fees started and the settlements, the American Writers Guild and another sort of writers union went after Google, it was a very popular thing to say, all right, yeah, we want to get all this stuff online. Google has the equipment and the technical know-how. We'll just turn it over. And Darnton says it cost Harvard almost $2 million to make this transaction, to actually get the volumes to Google and have it scanned by them.
But the irony of giving it over to a corporation. I mean, right. It's just I could see maybe giving it over to the U.S. government or to the EU, as you were saying. But I've always been shocked at that little transaction happening.
Yeah, I think it's crazy to hand it all over to a corporation. And the only plus side that I can see to that is that Google makes everything so easy, and that I could see this, you know, this public library being produced and having it become extremely complicated to use or to manage or to find anything. And people would rather have Google steal all of their personal information and sell it to advertisers and then go on to Google's website and Google something within their books very easily and just use it. It's, I don't know, I think people are more willing to part with that sort of private information for ease of use sometimes.
So that would be the Google Plus, you might call it. I think, though, that once a corporation gets it there, it's inevitable that they monetize it.
Yes, and I think that's horrible.
And also, what happens if Google, I mean, I know it's unforeseeable right now, but if Google goes out of business, you know, we have all these, you know, who's gonna own them? I think Kevin was saying that the European model seems to work well, too.
Yeah.
And I think he's trying to advocate for that here.
Right. And what I don't understand also, though, is like, why does Google get the rights at all? Like, they just started first, so then that's it? You know, is there another reason besides the fact that they started to do it?
I think what you were saying, I mean, they make everything easy. They have the technical know-how. They have the resources, all of that. I mean, the snowball's rolling, so it's just getting bigger and bigger. Another drawback, though, were Google to have all of human culture in print a part of their company, they can exclude what they want.
Right.
They can exclude a page here or there or a book. So that's a concern.
Right.
Censorship.
And for that reason, I would rather spend some extra time going through what, you know, might be just as good a search engine or not, but, you know, some kind of alternate public search engine, then go through the Google corporate version.
Now, what's the if I can ask this question, what's the most recent development? Is Google allowed to do this according to the judge's ruling?
No. In I guess it was March 23rd this year, the federal judge here in Manhattan denied the settlement that Google had negotiated with the two major writers' unions for a number of reasons. A lot of authors aren't covered by these. There was a lot of concerns. A lot of guys said, a lot of authors said, you know, look, I don't have to go through the union. I'm not looking for compensation. I would rather just make the work that I've done, whatever I publish, available for free and a larger publicly run database rather than hand it over to Google for some compensation. That would be so minimal. These are a lot of non-professional writers, more like academics, who publish, you know, not for a living, but to enhance whatever discipline they're in. So that's the latest development, stall. There's a stall. And now it seems Darton is sort of pressing on the gas to get a public project going. And apparently he's got a lot of backers, you know, like Library of Congress, National Endowment for the Humanities, the Mellon Foundation, all these things.
Well, does not sound like a problem we'll solve before the end of the podcast, but hopefully it will.
If they're looking for money from us, they probably won't solve it.
But for now, we'll have to stew on this.
You mean the two published authors that we have?
Right, I was going to say, we'll keep an eye out for the Jesuit Guide on Google Books or somewhere else.
And also your book on prayers. Don't forget that.
We'll keep an eye out. I think that they'll probably go for yours first. Anyway, thank you both, and thank you for listening.
My pleasure.
Thank you.